طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This week, Professor Hatem Bazian casts a critical eye on some of the myths that direct the Zionist narrative. He underscores how the racism and inhumanity of the colonist project and the inconsistencies of the biblical narrative clash with archaeological and historical reality that reveals truths that explode Zionist myths. Hatem Bazian is professor of Asian American and Asian Diaspora Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the co-founder and assistant professor at Zaytuna College, which is the only accredited American college in which the curriculum is based on Islamic fundamentals. He's also a co-founder of Students for Justice in Palestine. Here is Professor Hatem Bazian.
What I'm focusing today on is from occupation to apartheid and colonization, and it's for us, it's important to understand how to frame and understand Palestine as a cause that both for Muslims as well as anyone that is dedicated for human rights at a global level. What I want people to, if you want to come out of this discussion, is one: Palestine is not a conflict between two people that don't understand each other. Right? It's not a communication problem that you could hire a public relations firm that possibly sells what you call Fair and Lovely or Coca-Cola product, and we could get together and have a retreat and come out with a communication problem that is solved. So that's important. Second, it's not a problem of occupation, even though the Palestinians are occupied, because occupation implies that there is one state occupying another state. So it's not an occupation, even though that it is part of an occupation. And what we need is to understand what specifically how to understand Palestine. For understanding Palestine and what happens today, we need to understand the six features of settler colonialism. I have a book that I did not bring any books, but a book that you could access, Palestine, It Is Something Colonial. That's the title of the book. The title came out of a letter that Herzl wrote to Cecil Rhodes. Cecil Rhodes was the Minister of Colonies in Great Britain, and for those who were in the khutbah in Jum'ah, I say alhamdulillah that Great Britain is no longer great because only Allah is great. It used to be said that Great Britain, that the sun never set on the British Empire, because from one side of the globe to the other, the British had colonial possessions. Now the British don't have any colonial possession. They have to go to Greece in order to get some suntan. God does have a long lens of justice, and we need to appreciate this aspect of it. So when we speak about Palestine, Palestine is the last settler colonial project to be commissioned by Western powers. So let me repeat this. Palestine is the last settler colonial project to be commissioned by Western powers in order to create a colonial outpost in Palestine. In order to understand this, we have to look at what I call the six features of settler colonialism and colonialism in general. One, it was global. When the British were thinking about Palestine, they were thinking about how to protect India. Now you say, what is the relationship of Palestine to India? I know that the Palestinians don't eat spicy food. They like hummus and kanafa. Me too. And the Indian, they like spicy food. Right? Therefore, when I visited Kerala, India, the biggest struggle for me was the spice. So, alhamdulillah, they found some non-spicy food in order to address my need as a Palestinian in Kerala, India. So what is the relationship between India and Palestine? India for the British Crown was the prize. They ravaged India. Close to $15 trillion was the British intake out of India. Most of that trade was passing through the Red Sea, and as the Suez Canal was opened, was passing through the Suez Canal to the British and to Europe. Whoever controlled the waterways of Bab al-Mandeb in Yemen and the Suez Canal controlled the trade, global trade. You remember a couple of months ago when a ship ran aground on the Suez Canal, we came to know that 12 to 14% of global trade, 12 to 14% of global trade passes through the Suez Canal. So it's not only in the late 1800s, but also in the 21st century, most of the products in the world pass through waterways. Okay, very important. In 1914, 85% of the world's surface was a colony. You are either colonized by the British, the French, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the Italians, the Germans, and the Spanish. So 85% of the world's surface. So when the British were thinking out of Palestine, they're thinking about how to secure trade and make sure that their livelihood, which was carried out through the waterways, is maintained. So that's point one. Second, which is global, and second, it was economic, technological, and military projects. So the advancement of military projects, the advancement of economic underpinnings, that's why much of the coastal areas were made into trading posts for the British and the French and the Portuguese. Less so, the Spanish were kicked out of the Indian Ocean areas. Now, a note in here, many of the political structures that we see in the Global South are post-colonial global structures. These are elites that were trained, educated, and came back to run the colonies once the colonial forces left. Because we often say, why these countries continue to be in the way that they are? Again, these were, how many of you visit 7-Eleven, right? 7-Eleven is a franchise. The Global South, these post-colonial states, are political franchises. Their economy is still controlled, dominated, right? Their military is trained by a Global North. So it is an economic, technological, military structure. Third, it's a racial structure. So when the Zionists came to Palestine, they saw themselves as being European, bringing civilization, right, to civilize the East. And not only that, they also were engaging in racism toward also the religious Jews. So Zionism itself was both racial in relation to the Arab Palestinians, but also was racist toward religious Jews, because they were blamed for not being, in essence, strong, not being embracing modernity, not being, in essence, a fully functioning community that would take its place in society. So if you read the early Zionists, you will see their complete racial discourse. So when the Zionists look at a Palestinian, he is looking at a subhuman person. Do you understand this? To explain to you, when a police officer shoots a black person, he or she are thinking that they're shooting someone that is less than human. That has been the norm in relations to the colonial period. Right? Again, you know, you often think about how we could rationalize racism. It's, again, it's one of the longest calamity that we have with us. But the past 500 years have made racism as part of public policy, part of entertainment. And yesterday I said that one of the most widely used creams in the world is Fair and Lovely, which burn your skin. So modernity's contribution made humans hate themselves, which in essence hating God's creation. And if you want to think of it theologically, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran says, وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمَ. Every human being is ennobled. You don't need Fair and Lovely to be dignified. You're dignified because your mother gave birth to you in a state of dignity that is constitutive of who you are as a human being. So again, we need to understand this racial aspect to it. Fourth, settler colonialism is situated on genocide of the indigenous population. You don't need to go to Palestine to understand it. Look in relations to here in the Americas. Right? We're all in here, in Texas, we're standing on indigenous people's land. So part of thinking of Palestine is also you need to think about where we are today. You have to be consistent in speaking about settler colonialism in America as you speak about settler colonialism in Palestine, which is very difficult. Because we have absorbed what I consider to be, that we accepted to be in the framework of America and the white picket fence. We're coming here to live the American dream. You need to ask whether that American dream resonates with the indigenous population, because the rest of them who were not committed to genocide were transferred into reservation in the same way that Palestinians were sent to refugee camps. That is normative in relations to settler colonialism. If you study South Africa, you will see the same thing. If you study even parts of India during the British colonization, the shifting of the population, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Palestine is facing the same settler colonial genocide and transfer. One part of genocide that has to be understood as well is what we call epistemic genocide. I know this is a very academic term, epistemic. Epistemic means the way of knowing. Right? The way of knowing. All of us today, without exception, maybe of some few people here and there, are looking at the world through European lens. We experience and look at the world and analyze the world through Eurocentric lens. History, we understand history through European history. For example, the notion, well, we need to separate church and state, right? That's a European framing. Europe had an experience with the church, the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church was corrupt in Europe, divine rights of king, and therefore they needed to break away from the church. That's not the experience of the Muslims, because we don't have divine rights of king. We did not have the mosque running. We have a completely different discourse. It's not the experience of the Chinese. So when you say that statement, you need to understand that you have internalized the ways of knowing of Eurocentricity. Another thing we say, in the Middle Ages, or during the Dark Ages, it was dark in one neighborhood, they didn't have electricity in Europe. The rest of the world did not have the Dark Ages. Actually, it was very, very much lit. People were traveling and visiting Muslim lands and saying how beautiful it is and how light-filled these areas were. Chinese actually had the height of their civilization during that period. So when you say Middle Ages, Dark Ages, you need to understand that you are looking and experiencing the world through a Eurocentric eyes. That is part of the impact of colonization. Enslavement, controlled labor, right? Enslavement of the indigenous population first. The first group of slaves to be taken were taken from the new territory into Europe. Columbus' second journey, he took 1,000 native population, only one-third arrived. Then after that, followed by the enslavement of close to between 15 to 30 million. 15% of those, some say 20%, were Muslims that were brought to this new world. In the colonial period, which include Palestine, is that colonized people are used as commodified labor, meaning that their labor is used in order to advance and build the colony, especially after you commit a group to genocide, those remaining, you use them as a labor force. South Africa was the same. Palestine, and this is actually what people need to understand, the settlements in Palestine are built by Palestinian labor. Let me repeat this. The settlements are built by Palestinian labor. Now, is it the Palestinians don't understand that they're building the structure that is oppressing them? They do understand, but in here, it's either hunger and death or actually working under these conditions. That is normative. In the same way that black slaves built the White House, and we had to wait until 2008 for a black person to sit on the chair in the White House that was built by slaves. Right, so that has to be understood as part of settler colonialism. Religious and biblical justification. This is, again, a very important piece. The first to push for creating a Jewish state in Palestine was not the Jewish community. If you go back, it was actually Napoleon when he came into his campaign on Egypt in 1797. He wrote asking the Jews of the Ottoman Empire to join him. The Jews of the Ottoman Empire said, "No, sir, we're not interested." So they didn't accept his offer. And to remind you that Napoleon took a campaign in Palestine, and the Palestinian defeated Napoleon in the shores of Akka. I know when you have what you call the History Channel, they don't mention that because they want to make Napoleon as what you call the fountainhead, this great person. Tell anyone that Ashilo says the Palestinians defeated Napoleon. And he had to trace himself back into Egypt, and then the British confronted him at the shores of Alexandria. Right? But that begins a different history in relations to British influence control of Egypt. So, religious justification. Also, the British began to create a fund for archaeological discoveries in Palestine in order to trace the biblical history and the biblical narrative. A fact that you need to know. The British archaeologist from the 1800s up to around 1970, they were going to Palestine, to Jordan, to Lebanon, to Syria, to Egypt, not to look at the evidence and make conclusion on the evidence. They went there, the conclusion was already made, and wanted to fit the evidence onto the conclusion. If you have ever done a research as a student, you begin first with a hypothesis. You go out to do your research, 1, 2, 3, 4 points. You go and look at the evidence. You write whatever you come, and then you come up with your conclusion. You don't give a conclusion, and then you go and find pieces to fit the evidence. So, archaeological field was set up by the British. You could also bring the Germans and later on the Americans, doing archaeological diggings in order to authenticate and present the biblical narrative. Interestingly enough, wherever they found anything, they actually put the name, biblical name on it, even though it did not correspond to it. All right, so again, it was colonial archaeology. This colonial archaeology results in transformation of the names. Names of areas, names of regions. And as early as 1865, the British had a whole project for documenting and mapping Palestine archaeologically as it relates to the biblical text. Now, anyone that, again, looks at the field of archaeology, every time you dug something in Palestine, a Canaanite came out jumping. Right? Because the oldest population in Palestine are the Canaanites. Right? Even in the Bible, using just as a historical text, it said that the prophet Abraham migrated from Mesopotamia to the land of the Canaanites. It says that Abraham spoke the language of the Canaanites. More importantly, it says that he lived as an alien among the Canaanites. Right? I say that Palestinians gave him an early green card, right, to live among them. This is important because you have what you call the Zionists using the religious text, even though if you listen to Ilan Pape, he said that the most Zionists don't believe in God, but they believe that God gave them the land. That's what Ilan Pape, I think it was a beautiful summation, that Zionism is a secular project, secular nationalist project, utilize religious discourse to justify their project. They don't believe in God, but they do believe that God gave them the land. So every once in a while, you get a Zionist that opens and say, well, this is what God says. But God says something else, you know, 2, 3 pages down the line. Often the argument, which is also for individuals who are arguing and talking about Palestine, history of Palestine does not begin with the Bible. Okay, let me repeat this. History of Palestine does not begin with the Bible. Even if you take the Bible to look at it as both as a spiritual and historical text, it dates back to 1000 BC. Even some say it was written I'm talking about the Old Testament, around 570 during the exile period. The history of Palestine can be traced from archaeological discovery to about 35,000 years. The oldest olive tree in the world is in Palestine. It's 6,500 years old. The archaeological discoveries point to Palestine being the earliest place of civilization, agriculture, domestication of animal, irrigation system, the oldest city in Jericho, or some say Jericho or Damascus. So again, when you begin by saying 1000 BC, you're accepting biblical Zionist narrative that begins to say that Palestine belonged to us because we were there 1000 BC. Now, there is no dispute that the early Jewish community post-Moses period came to Palestine. That's not a dispute. But if we look at historical progression, the longest control over Palestine is actually the Egyptian. The longest rule of Palestine is actually the Egyptian rule during various periods. So the fact that the Jews came to Palestine from outside does not negate the history before, during, and after. I think sometimes Muslims who begin to engage in this discussion, they begin to enter into a debate about the Bible, the history, and so on. And in doing so, you erase the history of the Canaanites, the history of Palestine in general. Sometimes of good intention, but good intention by themselves are not sufficient. So we need to understand, when we say centering Palestinian history, is centering history as history, which is different than religious history. And again, to those who understand, religious history is not akin to history. Right? There is a distinction in here. Doesn't mean that you don't learn lessons, but in doing so, you often erase Palestinian history. Even if you think about the digging around Jerusalem, right, the oldest wall in relation to Jerusalem, it dates back to the Canaanites. We know again from the religious narrative that when Abraham migrated to Palestine, it was already a vibrant society. Right? So again, very important in understanding in this. Western Christianity has to be held responsible as much as Zionism for adopting and wanting to push for the Zionist colonial project for its own interest. Because, again, in here you're in the South with the evangelical right, the Hagee and the Friends of Israel. They're supporting Israel, not because all of a sudden they love the Jewish community, or all of a sudden they discovered that they hate Muslims. They're equal opportunity, they hate both. But they believe, this is again their own theology, speculative theology, that the return of Jesus is situated on the support for the state of Israel, the reconstituting of the children of Israel in Palestine. And when Jesus comes, you ask the question, Philip Hagee, what happens? Well, 2/3 of the Jews will be killed, and 1/3 will convert to Christianity. While the Muslims are seen to be from the realm of Satan, we don't even qualify to an affirmative action inclusion. We don't even have the possibility of conversion. That's their own theology. You don't take my word for it. Go and look at, you know, Christian Zionism and what their belief system in this sense. So they are using speculative theology, evangelical speculative theology, to push for support for Israel for their own purposes. And if the Muslims and Jews kill each other, might as well they're supporting actors in a theater piece that they are actually not actors in it. The role of Muslims and Jews or Southern Hemisphere is for us to bring the tea on the stage, give it to the Western evangelical, Western civilization, and exit stage left. Because there is only one true history from their perspective, is the history that is contained in the biblical narrative as it's been interpreted, understood with their speculative theology. Okay, that is an important piece to understand, because you ask, why the evangelicals are so much supportive of Israel? Or also some other mainstream Christian groups that sometimes they still would support it because theologically they find argumentation to it. And increasingly you find some of the black churches using that same logic as well. So it's very important to understand that this is part of the discourse that we're dealing with. And it was present in colonial discourse as well. Many of you possibly understood Manifest Destiny, right? The white man burden, that we want to civilize the world and Christianize the world. And there was a debate, you know, throughout on this notion. That debate still have an effect in relations to Palestine. So that's very, very important in this sense. So these are the six features that we need to understand when we are discussing Palestine. Right? Otherwise, you really are entering into conversation and you're getting lost in the minutiae or the details on that is there. Now let me shift a little bit to speak about the most recent development. So this should be the framework behind, in the back of your minds. Palestinians today in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as 48, are feeling the impact of the Oslo Agreement. If you don't know the Oslo Agreement, it's an agreement that was signed in September 13, 1993, by which the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, recognized Israel, while Israel recognized the PLO as the agency or as the group to negotiate with Israel for final solution, or the final status for the Palestinian areas. Through that agreement, it actually led to the decentering of the PLO, which is actually is very, the PLO was not as, I would say, as not as smart as they thought they are. Because they thought that Israel recognizing the PLO as the agency to negotiate with Israel will bring PLO into center stage. It actually decentered the PLO, and in its place created the Palestinian Authority. And it became the focus of negotiations. Now, I've written around what happened for Oslo immediately thereafter. I said at the time that Israel, as a result of the first uprising, was accustomed to having its own style of colonization. It wanted its own form. It wanted to control every neighborhood. It wanted to know how much beans there is in each falafel. It wanted to monitor the amount of sugar in each of the kenafas all over the West Bank. Literally, they wanted four reports from each corner in every part of the West Bank. That security structure collapsed as a result of the uprising. So Israel was actually searching for a new model or a way to replace its security structure. So the Oslo Agreement brought the Palestinian Authority as a security structure to secure Israel's settlements and settlers from the Palestinians. All right, so again, it began to be that Israel brought the Palestinian Authority to be its security infrastructure to secure its own population, settler populations in the West Bank. I compared it to South Africa. During the apartheid period, the ANC was leading the anti-apartheid movement. The South Africa apartheid structure engaged Chief Buthelezi and projected that Chief Buthelezi is the leader of the black South Africans, opposite Nelson Mandela, who was in jail. And for a period of time, the South African white apartheid regime succeeded in projecting that image. But as the intensity of opposition to the South Africa apartheid structure became more pronounced, Chief Buthelezi was ineffective in maintaining hold of the black population, and the ANC was successful in opposing and ending apartheid South Africa's regime with the support of the international community. I argued then and I can maintain that the Palestinian Authority was brought to reconstitute a classical form of colonization where you recruit a small group of the indigenous colonized people and you empower them to rule over the colonial subject while protecting the colonial population and you protect the infrastructure of the colonial enterprise. We saw it in India. Again, for those who are aware, you know, British created native courts. They engaged with relations with the Raj that gave them power over the population. And most of the Indians often were oppressed by other Indians who were in relationship to the British. That's what the Israelis and Zionists moved with the Oslo Agreement, and the Palestinian Authority accepted this. The Oslo also severed relations with the young population. So you actually find a demarcation, especially post-2000. The young Palestinian population were completely disconnected from the broader discourse that was taking place post the signing of Oslo. That is also was positive because they did not have the same fears or the same impediments that were present in the older generation without problematizing those who are old, because some are old but are still young in resisting, while there are some young that are old in relations to giving up. So again, this is not the framing. But it severed structurally that relationship. It removed Palestine from communal organizing space. For those who know the Palestinians in the United States, during the 80s, the 90s, the Palestinians were connected to the Palestinian structure. You actually used to relate to PLO work, flyers, material, fact sheets, information. Post-Oslo, and I would point from 1993 till today, I would challenge anyone within the Palestinian community nationally to have received a fact sheet, a study or analysis that is coming from the PLO. More importantly, part of Oslo required that the PLO should withdraw its international aspect of its work, which means it actually disempowered the PLO, which at the time was far more recognized internationally than Israel. But Oslo has also weakened the Palestinians in a transnational way. There was an emergence of Islamic organizations, which again, AMP can be one of that. But with it also, this is something that we need to critique, the normalization camp. What do I mean by normalization? Most likely you heard recently about the critique of ISNA and its relationship with AJC, the American Jewish Committee. Also, most likely you heard of what's called the MLI, Muslim Leadership Initiative, that was taking young Muslims from America to take them on a fully paid trip by the Zionists to Palestine so they would understand how Palestine is important to the American Jewish community, which is a normalization. And when they come back, they speak Zionist language, right? They blame the Palestinians. They would say that they were inspired by what they saw on a fully paid trip. And this whole interfaith washing that has developed. More importantly, also, the normalization in the Muslim world. The countries that have recognized Israel, whether it's United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Mauritania, Egypt, Jordan, there is a press on Sudan. Bangladesh has a commercial interest office for Israel. Qatar, likewise, have engaged in normalizations in one way or the other. And also Turkey has a long-standing diplomatic relation, so I'm an equal opportunity in my critique in this sense. But normalization, that Israel becomes a partner in the region rather than being seen as a colonial enterprise. And increasingly people say, well, you know, We just live and let live. Well, that's okay, live and let live. Well, they're not letting us live to begin with. Right? They're demolishing Palestinian homes daily. We're in the 21st century, right? We're on June, right, 5th, 2021. And we have on the newspapers settlers taking over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. You know, if we read this in the 1500s, like when Columbus got lost on his way to India and the native discovered that he was lost and there were settlements, we would understand this. But we're in the 21st century, right? And the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Uncle Biden saying that Israel has the right to defend itself in stealing Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah and building settlements. And more importantly, your State Department saying that settlements are only an impediment to peace. Settlements are illegal and an international law that you developed, not us. Right? I did not write the 4 Geneva Convention. Right? I read it, but it's not me. Right? When Europe, maybe I'll get a little bit in here, when Europe massacred the world in World War I and World War II, they got together and wrote the 4 Geneva Convention. It's your convention that says we have a set of rules by which we're going to adhere because we're not going to allow what we did, not me, but Europe, Europe did, causing the death of 50 to 70 million people. We're not going to allow it to happen. Right? That's the 4 Geneva Convention passed in 1949 after the Second World War. So, 4 Geneva Convention, you wrote it. State Department, you have a specialist. We have a professor at UC Berkeley, John Yu, who said that the 4 Geneva Convention is a passé, it's no longer applicable because he wrote the memos for torture in Iraq, which got the United States in trouble. We found that the 4 Geneva Convention is still one of the documents that governs how we relate in times of war. So, Mr. Biden, Blinken in the State Department, for the settlements are not impediment to peace, they are war crimes and illegal under your document, not ours. So we're in the 21st century and we're still talking about settlements, settlers. So it's not live and let live, they're not letting us live and we're not living. And I'm not touching the Gaza Strip. 65% of it is refugees from 1948, ethnically cleansed. The largest open-air prison that still day in and day out being bombed. Water that is no longer... The UN said by 2020, that's last year, before even COVID, that the water is no longer usable for human consumption. That's 2020. After 2021 now, what is it used for? Calorie intake of Gaza is the only place on earth where the height of people are diminishing because your calorie intake are causing stunted growth among the Gazan population. What is the world response? Our politicians here, Hamas, 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 is like hummus, Hamas, they're confusing it, right? They don't understand the difference. You speak to them about human rights, it's Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. Again, this is what you call a problem, Musmar Juha. The Juha is this funny character, it's Musmar Juha. Using that to have an F-16 bombing, right? All these residential towers. And the Israeli pilot said, is actually just to vent out. It's a war crime. Our politicians say Israel has the right to defend itself. Venting out. That's why these apartment buildings were hit. Not because there is Hamas, not because it is venting. That's a pilot saying what the reason for bombing these residential spaces. And when the media building gets bombed, the media apologizes. Right? The AP building was completely bombed to smithereens. In any other context, I bet you, again, I said in the Washington, D.C. march, I come from Berkeley. If a cat gets stuck on the tree, we'll get a petition to try to create the environment so the cat would not get stuck on the tree. If a dog get to be what you call injured, we'll have a march down in order to get the city council to make changes to make the street safe for the dog. Rightly so. My students are the ones that hugged the tree and went and climbed the tree in order to prevent the cutting of the trees. Rightly so. Again, the Prophet, I said, hugged the tree when he was giving the khutbah and they built a minbar for him. He got on the minbar and he heard the tree feeling the pain. He hugged the tree to calm it down. So I have no problem with people hugging a tree. I'd rather for you hug a tree than go and actually drink what you call these big gulps and hug it like 54 ounces of complete garbage that people consume. But when it comes to Palestine, all of your liberals, all of your people that have caught on every cause, they're out to Mars with Elon Musk. You don't find them. They're trying to see if they find a Palestinian in Mars to free them. But Palestinians that are there in Palestine are completely forgotten. And they give you the lamest excuses. Well, there is two sides to every issue. There is a rape and rapist. There is two sides. But this two sides is one of the easiest escapable discourses that you could get. Because it equalizes between the oppressed and oppressor, the colonizer and the colonizer, the victim and the victimizer. So this nonsense of the two sides in a colonial structure, had it been in the United States, you would actually have to go and interview the slave owners. How do you feel, oh slave owner, that your slaves rebelled against you? It must be traumatizing for you, so we need a therapist for you at one of our universities. Because it's really very difficult that all of a sudden 100 slaves escaped from your control and rebelled against you. I know. We need an action in Congress to prohibit slaves from rebelling, which happened. So this discourse of the two-sidedness is often used as a way to rationalize the continued oppression of the Palestinians. So let me try to conclude with the following. Palestine needs people that understand how to advocate and speak on Palestine. And I want you also, and I think Miko is going to come and speak after me, I don't want any of the nonsense that people get into that begin to correlate and mix between criticizing Israel and criticizing Jewish and Judaism. That has to be completely exit out of any of our discourse. Yes, we have theological differences with Judaism. Again, that is nothing new. There are polemical, large work on that, like we have differences with Christianity on theological issues, as Muslims have differences theologically. Again, have you ever discussed, had a Shia Sunni having a discussion in terms of the differences? Sometimes people enter into the conversation mixing their brains between theological debates that are the realm of religious discourse and debate versus dealing with settler colonialism of Zionism. So that has to be completely jettisoned and nothing to do. Second, you are not helping Palestine or the Palestinians by standing in there and beginning to argue anything relative to the Holocaust. There are people, which I consider to be completely oblivious, stand up and begin to speak about the Holocaust in ways that both is insulting to Palestine, but also insulting to the Jewish community. Engaging in this conversation does not help Palestine or the Palestinians. One is you have nothing, you have no history, you have not studied that history yourself. And the second, if there is anything, you actually tell Europe that the Holocaust belonged to your history and you need to answer for it. So it is none of your business to begin the whole conversation of denial and beginning to diminish the Holocaust. And I understand people think that the Palestinians are suffering pointing to the people that are causing you suffering by denying their suffering does not do anything to your suffering that is taking place. So it's not an Olympics of suffering that you're negating the suffering of the Jews in Europe is not a way for you to assert what is taking place in Palestine. And some begin to argue the numbers. No, it's not 5 million, it's 6 million, it's 4.5 million. That for me is like compounded insanity. Affirm and begin to understand that history belongs to European history and understand it and completely de-link it, even when Zionists begin to argue and use anti-Semitism as a weapon against us. That should not give us the reason or the excuse to enter into that conversation of negation. Sometimes out of what you call, out of our way to try to center the pain of the Palestinians, we begin to engage in that conversation. So it's very important because, again, often we get into these conversations that are just completely erroneous. You are not helping, you're adding to the pain and suffering. There's so much in Palestinian issues to cover. You leave that and you just go and jump to Germany. Right? Hitler belongs to Europe. Mussolini belongs to Europe. Europeans have normatively engaged in genocide. That's not our point. They expelled Muslims from 1492, the expulsion and the Inquisition. So it's nothing new. You are not arguing the Holocaust did not happen. Are you trying to defend Hitler? To say, well, no, Hitler was a nice guy? Hitler was an equal opportunity. He hated everyone other than the superior whiteness, which was the ultimate racial discourse that you have. I'm saying this because it's very, very important and critical because people get into social media, enter into this conversation, and they think, right, that they're helping the Palestinians. Ask what was the Palestinian position on Hitler and Germany. The papers in the 1930s, Palestinians were writing against Hitler and the Nazi project. They rejected, even at the time, which would have been rational, they rejected actually being sucked into that type of discourse. These are the newspapers from the 1930s in Palestine. So that's very, very critical for us to understand in order for us to engage in this conversation. The last, and this is my last statement, is that I do believe that change is coming and transformation is underway. But silence by itself is not going to change anything. And I know that people say, well, we're waiting for Salah al-Din to come. I say, if Salah al-Din comes, you will be in Starbucks drinking latte and possibly say he doesn't have the right wudu. What I want, if Salah al-Din comes, is to say that the Salah al-Din you're waiting for is here, is you. Get up and get to work. That's all what I say. So don't, what you call, almost like get in a state of drunkenness, imagining history. These are people that are nostalgic. They never change history. Get up, make history, and let people be nostalgic about what you do. That's my advice for you in relations to Palestine. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum.
You have been listening to University of California, Berkeley, Professor Hatem Bazian. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.